Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Juan Carlos Bravo. For nearly a decade, Juan Carlos oversaw the Northern Jaguar Reserve and attended to its day-to-day management. At Wildlands Network, as Wildlands Network's Director of Operations in Mexico, he now works to expand the Western Wildlight into the Northern Sierra Madre Occidental by partnering with Mexican groups and improving Wildlands Network's understanding of the connectivity issues in Mexico. He adapts Wildlands Network's overall strategy to a significantly different conservation landscape by applying tactics that are regionally appropriate but seek the same ultimate goal, wilderness conservation and connectivity with a focus on large landscapes and big carnivores. So first, thank you for your important work. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, thank you, Derek, for inviting me, and hello to all your audience.
So before we turned on the interview, I said I was going to ask you first about jaguars. I'm still going to do that. But an additional thing is, through the conversation, at some point, can we talk about this, what is a wild way and what are these connectivity issues? Can we eventually get to that too?
Sure, they're both very much connected.
Great. So the first question is, just tell me about jaguars.
Well, jaguars are the third largest feline in the planet. They are an animal that is usually considered a tropical animal. Most people, when thinking about jaguars, imagine them in lush jungles of Central and Southern America. But the truth is they reach way into Northern America. And not only do they cover vast parts of Mexico, but they also occasionally visit the United States. These jaguars used to be native of the southwestern United States and were exterminated through campaigns brought on by governments to eliminate carnivores that were perceived as harmful to people or livestock. And jaguars are not only a vast-ranging species, they're also very, very impressive in many ways. There are cats that like to swim. They are considered to have one of the strongest bites in the animal kingdom. Some people presume that this was an evolutionary adaptation to biting the heads of wild pigs, what we called javelinas and peccaries, that would otherwise trash and hurt a hunting jaguar. So in order to eliminate them quickly, they evolved a very, very fast and strong bite. These cats are, most of them are spotted, very much like leopards. They are the biggest spotted cat in the world and in our continent. And some of them occasionally are melanistic, which is they are completely black. And when that happens, people will call them black panthers, though we don't have any reliable record of a black jaguar anywhere in Mexico, let alone in the United States. There are a lot of anecdotal sightings of them. It's hard to say. So these cats are usually surrounded by this aura of mystery, and people have all kinds of beliefs around them. They were very, very important to the native cultures of my country, Mexico. They were regarded as embodiments of gods and spirits, and would used to symbolize things like strength and courage. So there were also high-ranking warriors among some Mexican pre-Hispanic cultures that were called the Jaguar Warriors, precisely because they were so ferocious, and they would don the pelts of these animals. But there are all these kinds of stories that one could tell about jaguars and what they mean to people. They are also a threatened species, protected under international conventions, protected both in Mexico and the United States and every other country where they occur. and are losing a lot of their habitat through landscape transformation. They are also the victims, of course, of poaching, which occurred mostly in the 20th century because of their interest in their coats to be used for fur coats. And now they are still being hunted, not so much as an item for fashion, but for trophy hunting and for as a way to reduce the impact or in some cases perceived impact on livestock.
So can you tell me a little bit more about their range prior to conquest? You said they were up in the United States, and how far up did they go? And then also, how far south did they go, and how far south do they still go?
They used to go as far south as northern Argentina, and I believe there are still some that are occasionally found in southern Brazil in that region, but they have lost some of that area. In terms of their northern range, they used to go for sure as north as Colorado and Utah. It's hard to say for sure how much farther they went, but they did go into different parts of New Mexico and Arizona, and probably even California, Nevada. Those southwestern states certainly saw jaguars, and some of them, like Arizona and potentially New Mexico, are seeing a few of them making it back to the United States.
So a few more questions just about the creatures themselves before we move on. You mentioned the thing about them being thought of as a jungle creature and liking water, but it seems that they, it seems from what you're saying that they also can be adapted to desert, or when they came up north, or when they came to, when they go through desert areas, do they mainly stick to the riparian zones, or do they actually go out into the more open as well?
They're not likely to move about in open places, but they're also not constricted to riparian areas. They like in their northernmost range, they move about in a habitat that's called Sinaloan thorn scrub. And this is a habitat of low trees and lots of bushes, most of them, yes, with thorns or poisonous, not very inviting for hikers and picnickers. But because of that, it has also remained mostly undeveloped. And it is this kind of landscape that jaguars really appreciate, though they will move to other kinds of covered habitat in search of prey. They have adapted themselves to all kinds of different weather. They can reach as high altitudes as places where you can find pine and oak trees. But they will certainly prefer mid-range altitudes where they have enough cover, water, and of course prey, which is apparently the principal determining factor of their presence.
Well, that leads to a couple more questions, which is, you said they're the third largest cat. Can you say how big, like, are they 100 pounds? Are they 80 pounds? and also, you mentioned the peccaries, but what else do they eat? What are a lot more of their food? And how do they eat? My understanding of mountain lions, for example, is that often they will hunt by ambush, and I don't know about lions or tigers, but so how do they, how big are they? Whom do they eat, and how do they catch them?
Okay. I'll have to do a few conversions here to imperial.
Oh, you can say kilograms. That's fine. People can figure it out.
Okay. So most of the jaguars in their northern range will be around 40 kilograms. That I think is around 89, 88 pounds. And that is the smallest end of their size range. When they go, as you go farther south, you'll see that they increase in size. And some of the animals in Brazil are recorded to be around 120 kilos. That's 265 pounds.
Oh, they're three times as big.
Yeah, they are. They do increase in size significantly. So yeah, when we're saying the third largest cat in the world, we mean actually as a species and those animals that that are in the regions where they achieve their biggest size. The ones we have in northern Mexico and occasionally in southwestern United States are about the size of a mountain lion, for those of you who have seen mountain lions, but they are bulkier. They are certainly stronger. They have massive jaws. They have very, very strong, shorter legs, and their tails are not as long as the tails on a mountain lion. They eat a wide range of animals. They eat deer, white-tailed deer, which is the species mostly found around here, but they will eat a lot of small carnivores, medium-sized carnivores, which is, if we have time, I'll explain a little about why that is so important. But I'm talking here about raccoons and quadrimundis and ring-tailed, you call them ring-tailed cats, I think. They're not cats. They're actually in the raccoon family. And they also will hunt for turtles, and they will fish, actually, since they like water. They will go into the water and fish. There are videos of a large jaguar eating a small alligator. They will eat all kinds of things. It's hard to say that they will specialize in something, you know. They'll eat what they'll find. And what they do is they also ambush. They wait about until they find the right moment, and then they lunge. And sometimes if they are very effective in their kill, and of course kills are messy things, and each one of them will be different, but if they can, they will go for the head. And they will pierce the head with their canines, big sharp teeth that pierce so hard the skulls of their prey, that if you find a skull lying out there with two perfectly neat circular holes, the chances are it was a jaguar, because they're the only animals that can bite that way without crushing the whole thing, just very much like bullet holes.
That's all really, really interesting stuff. Thank you. So I guess before we go on to something else, why don't you go ahead and say why that is important, so in case we forget later?
Well, it's important for biodiversity. A lot of people ask, what's the importance of keeping those large carnivores around? And, you know, you could do without them, and you could still have all the birds and the smaller animals running about. And that's actually not true. What has been found is that large carnivores like jaguars and cougars that prey on smaller carnivores keep a much diverse suite of species in the ecosystems where they live. And this is understood if you can think of a population, a closed population. This is what biologists like to study, such as islands where you won't have things moving in and out constantly. And studies in such places have shown that when you remove the large carnivores, the smaller carnivores suddenly, you could think of them as breeding out of control and eating everything they find. They will eat the birds' nests. They will eat the birds themselves. They will eat insects of all sizes. They will eat smaller mammals. They will eat reptiles and amphibians of smaller size. And so suddenly all the diversity that you had is overwhelmed by an unnatural abundance of just a few very effective, very opportunistic carnivores like raccoons. We all know how they can open complex logs. They can get what they want when they're determined to get it. And so imagine that there's no natural check for them, that the natural check for all these very clever, very and very prolific animals are large carnivores such as jaguars.
And then not only would they reduce the number of raccoons or whomever, but they would also force them out of some of their favorite places. It's like, without wolves, not only are there more grazers, but in addition, the grazers can get really lazy and just hang around the water. And one of the things that the wolves do is they push them around.
Yeah, for sure, it's reasonable to assume that the jaguars will also have an impact on the behavior of smaller carnivores and more alert and itchy behavior will probably result in less effectivity in preying on other wildlife. So yeah, but basically what jaguars do is give the little guys a chance by keeping the middle guys in check.
That's a great way to put it. So we, what is the both official and unofficial conservation status of jaguars over their range? Are they in trouble? Are they declining? Are they going back? Are they coming back? Are they, and what is the relation of, to your understanding, of the historical population versus current? And I'm thinking very quickly about, like, pronghorn antelope are sometimes called a success story because in about 100 years ago, there was only, I think, 26,000, and now there's, I don't know, 500,000 or something. But historically, there was about, I believe, 16 million. So, it's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great they're coming back, but they're still much lower than they were. So what was the historical population? What is the current population? What is the trend?
For animals such as jaguars that are so elusive, there's no way we'll ever know how many there were originally. There is very little chance of knowing how many there are currently. But there are some large-scale efforts conducted in Mexico and Brazil to find out. And from those, you can sort of extrapolate a little. I don't have the definitive figures in my head right now. But in terms of trends, it is interesting because there are thousands of jaguars throughout their range. The thing is, the range is so big that doesn't necessarily mean that there's the density you need or that there is the connectivity you need, because these animals will need to move about as they grow into adults and find new mates and new territories. And that's why the largest, the strongest influence on jaguars, negative influence, the biggest threat they face is the transformation of habitat. They are losing their habitat to all kinds of development. And because of this depletion of their habitat, their numbers are eventually reduced. It is estimated that as much as 50% of their original habitat has already been lost. So just to throw a guess, you could say, you know, we've lost 50% of jaguars in the past 100 years. Now, the interesting thing is that in some places like Brazil, and you could argue in the whole of Mexico, they are sufficiently abundant that that they're not in immediate threat of becoming extinct. But the argument is really would not be looking at the need for large spaces. What sense is there to say, okay, there are 2,000 jaguars in Mexico? That sounds like a lot. But the truth is, if they're scattered all over and some of them end up in isolated patches of jungle or thorn scrub without any chance of reconnecting to others, you could face a very quick demise in such a scenario. In places like the United States, right now there's only one lonesome male that's currently being recorded in Arizona, as far as I know. So until we have, you know, at least a female and a breeding population, it's really an extinct species, even though you could claim there is at least one for all biological and evolutionary processes. The animal is extinct in the United States. So it is important to bring it back. It is important to make sure that lonesome animal does not remain a lonesome animal forever. And the same holds true for different parts along their range. You just can't think of it, you know, as a herd animal. They cluster and move about together, and if you look at the herd, you sort of know how the species is doing. You know, if you look at a few herds, this is a very different dynamic with wide ranging carnivores.
And are they solitary? Except for breeding, are they solitary, or do they sometimes hang out together at all?
No, they are mostly solitary, like you said, except for breeding, and that just lasts a few days. The most common result is what you call it, a litter of two kittens, and one of them is statistically unlikely to survive its first years, and the other one at around 2 years of age will leave its mother and start looking for a small territory nearby if it's a female, and it will probably have to look much farther if it's a male.
Before we talk about the importance of connectivity and then also what efforts are being made to help them, there's another question that's just really occurring to me is, since they like water, I'm wondering, you know, I think a lot about the Colorado River and how it used to be this wonderful wetland down where it would reach the Gulf of Mexico, where it reaches the ocean.
This of California.
Yeah, thank you. And how that's gone. So in addition to all the other threats they faced, whether they're shooting, habitat conversion of other sorts, I'm guessing that the dewatering rivers has really harmed them too.
It's very hard for biologists to study these things and on the ground while they happen, you know. So the rest of us get, you know, some information, but it is certainly reasonable to assume that once you reduce the water in a river, the water flow, the whole habitat is going to change, and the amount the amount of vegetation will be reduced, the amount of animals that feed on that vegetation will be reduced, and so those being the prey of jaguars, the number of jaguars would be reduced or displaced.
So tell me about the efforts to help the jaguars that are being put forward by the organizations with which you've worked and other organizations. What is being done to help them?
Yeah, I worked for 15 years in an organization, a Mexican organization called Naturalia. It is one of the most important conservation groups in Mexico. And while I was working there, we successfully established the first private reserve dedicated to jaguars in all of Mexico. We started out with 10,000 acres, and then through a partnership with an Arizona-based group called the Northern Jaguar Project, we managed to expand these 10,000 acres to a total of 55,000 acres of this habitat I'm describing, the Sinaloan thorn scrub. This private reserve is maintained completely by donations. I would encourage anybody hoping to help jaguars return to the United States to look for Northern Jaguar Project online and do a tax-deductible donation to our partners in Arizona. Most of the money will make it to effective on-the-ground conservation in Mexico. That's one of the most relevant projects. There are other things certainly going on. After the creation of all this new border infrastructure in the United States, it was determined that that there should be some remediation payments made to compensate or mitigate the adverse effect of border infrastructure on wildlife. And a lot of money was put into monitoring jaguars on the Arizona side of the border. The University of Arizona is involved in coordinating such efforts. And there are many groups, mostly in Mexico, because that's where the jaguars are in this part of the world, that although they don't have jaguar as their flag species or their mascot or anything, they still help in one way or another to maintain the habitat that the jaguars need.
So 55,000 acres would be a typical range for how many jaguars could easily live in that much land?
That's a tough question. What we see is that jaguars move about a lot. And so at any given time, there's probably between 3 and 6 jaguars in this area. We have set up an array of over 100 cameras in the region, not only within the reserve, but also in the cattle ranches around the reserve, which is an important part of our outreach program. And what we see is that females more or less stay put in the same area. There's probably enough habitat there for 3 females to interact, which doesn't mean that they'll stay within the limits of the reserve. But that's more or less what's happening. And then males need a much larger habitat that will overlap the female's habitat, there's no overlap between male habitats. And so we'll see them crisscross the reserve and go in and then go out, and then we won't see them for a couple of years, and then suddenly one of them will return. And so it's really a very, very shifting scenario. It's hard to think of them as, okay, I've got this area and I've got these many within this area. It's very interesting to find out that nature is a lot more dynamic than the way we think.
Absolutely. In the United States, you mentioned ranchers down there. In the United States, one of the major threats to, for example, wolf recovery is there is a long-standing hatred of carnivores by a lot of ranchers, and a lot of ranchers will follow the 3 S's, which are shoot, shovel, and shut up.
Yeah.
And is there the same level of hatred of jaguars generally in – I want to be really clear. In the United States, it goes far beyond economic concern because there are programs to – pay the ranchers for every wolf who kills a cow. But there is this beyond economic dislike of them. Is the same thing true for the jaguars, both in your experience in the US and in Mexico?
The quick answer is no. The wolf is a completely different animal. You know, and Naturalia got involved in Mexico's first reintroduction, so I had a first-hand knowledge of ranchers' reactions to wolves. And I can tell you up front that for some reason, the wolf is still the most hated carnivore out there, even in Mexico. I am very sorry to say that. The silver lining, you could say, is that jaguars are a lot more tolerated in Mexico. Not necessarily appreciated. They're not necessarily well-liked. They are still poached regularly. I would say constantly. They are less conspicuous than wolves. That makes them harder targets. They don't howl about to let people know where they are. They don't stay in the same area regularly, so it's harder to poison them, but they still get poisoned every once in a while. And so there are still a lot of ranchers that kill them and that apply the same technique, or rather poison them, shovel and shut up. We had an incident just a year ago, and it was very hard because it had been a female we had monitored for several years. We had seen her, we had taken a picture of her with our camera traps when she was just a cub. And we later named her Corazón, which is Spanish for heart, because she had a heart-shaped spot. And that's why we could tell her apart from other jaguars. And we tracked Corazón for several years, and researchers from the university in Mexico at one point captured her and collared her and were monitoring her movements. until they realize she wasn't moving, and colors will send you a very distinct signal that's called a death signal. When an animal is not shifting about, it's not moving naturally. And when they sent a cowboy to check on what had happened, they found the burnt carcass of this female. This was just a few kilometers north of the reserve, outside of the limits of our reserve. It brought home the importance to continue the outreach work with the ranchers, because they're certainly not well tolerated still, and our reserve cannot hold all of them forever, right?
You brought up the border a while ago, and I live, you know, more than in the northern half of the country, and so my understanding of the border comes almost entirely from news reports. And, you know, I've seen pictures of how militarized it is and how there are these walls. Is it still porous enough for jaguars to get through?
Not everywhere. It has certainly limited the potential for animals to move from one place to another. There are different kinds of border infrastructure that have been put in place. All of them are completely useless in keeping people outside of the United States, but some of them are actually very effective in keeping animals on either side when they need to move about. And this goes both ways, because both the animals of Mexico need to find new territories or resources or mates in the United States, and the other way around. So in some places they've put the kind of infrastructure that they call Normandy barrier, which is made of crosses of old railroad bars, or I don't know exactly what you would call them, the rails themselves.
Ties.
Yeah, so they are put in crosses and welded together, and so these certainly look like they could stop a vehicle, but they can't stop a large cat. They will stop a pronghorn that's trying to cross. They will stop other animals, but a jaguar could certainly cross through it. Other places, they've done much more impermeable infrastructures where no animal can pass them, except, I don't know, an eagle or a hawk could fly over them. But even smaller owls have issues where they can't cross such infrastructures because they never fly that high.
Right. So you've talked, I think you made very clear the importance of large habitat. Can you talk about the importance then, and you've talked about the importance of connection some, can you talk about the importance of these, of large tracts of protected land then being connected to others, and talk about that in terms of, quote, expanding the Western Wild Way?
Yes, as scientists advance in their understanding of how nature works, one thing that became evident in the last decades of the past century was that there are certain processes that depended on scale, you know, and some of them are very evident for us to understand, but some of them were not so evident, and particularly for biologists, they didn't quite understand why it mattered. It seemed like a small reserve that had all that it needed would effectively stand fast and hold its biodiversity, but that was not happening. And there are many reasons why this happens. Some of them involve the presence of these large carnivores, and they themselves immediately need to move about. Imagine being a young male jaguar suddenly finding that all the territory around you is already claimed by different males. And so you have to move a long distance, sometimes as far as 100 miles, to find the right territory for you. So when you have these large animals that move such long distances, you need the landscape to accommodate them. what happens if you don't have the landscape? You could argue, well, you'll only lose those big ones. But just like in the example that I gave earlier, that these animals keep others in check, you have to understand that there is a minimum viable number of size of a population, the number of animals that will effectively find each other, breed, and maintain sufficient genetic diversity within their single species to keep on doing it constantly. And so you can't have that if you don't have the large spaces. And if you lose the large carnivores, then yeah, you lose the rest of the biodiversity in a region. And that's just one of those examples. Another thing that is evident to other people is migration. Some animals just need to use different parts of landscapes in different seasons throughout the year. And as they move about, they need those places to remain connected. Some migrations are very small in scale, regional. There are animals that spend the winter in Sonora and the summer in Arizona, and that's just, you know, around the corner for them in biological terms. They do still have to face, you know, the threats of being or of finding their routes segmented by infrastructure along the way. But other animals need a much larger landscape for migration, like monarch butterflies that use Canada, the United States, and Mexico throughout their life cycles. And so if you can't accommodate these migrations, this continental scale migrations, you're going to lose biodiversity. When losing biodiversity, somebody gave an example of it being like taking parts out of a flying airplane. You're throwing some out of the window and probably nothing will happen, but eventually you'll pick one out and you'll throw it out the airplane and the whole thing will collapse. So it doesn't make much sense to lose species if you depend on a system that is made up of species.
So what is the Wildlands Network and the Western, and specifically the Western Wildway?
The Western Wildway is a conceptualization, you could call it, of a massive continental corridor that will effectively maintain habitat connected between northern Mexico, the whole of the Rocky Mountains, the Canadian Rocky Mountains, and the Brooks Range in Alaska. This scale of connectivity will allow for the continued presence of vast ranging species, so anything from monarch butterflies to grizzly bears. You know, there used to be grizzly bears in northern Mexico and southwestern United States. So how much have we all lost by losing all these species throughout the years? And isn't it clear that we lost a lot of it because we destroyed their habitat? How do we recover it? How do we restore this level of wildness and uniqueness to our continent? How do we think beyond a single reserve or a single isolated patch of well-protected land and start thinking about what makes sense in terms of a continent and its wildlife? And in thinking about these things, what becomes also very evident is that you have a strategy that works very much in the same scale as global warming. We talk about global warming because it's global. And yeah, sure, small actions at home, like turning off the lights and taking shorter showers, will probably work. But the scale of the problem is global. How do you affect something like that on such a scale? And the way to do it, in my point of view, and others, of course, share it, is to think about a continental solution to these kinds of problems, making sure that there are carbon sinks big enough, healthy enough, connected enough to maintain their resilience throughout the different things that will happen throughout the years, and not just man-made threats, but also those threats that come about with a with a climate that is bringing stronger storms, more frequent wildfires, those kinds of things. And so you put this vision in place, and then you see how can we make it work and who's working already to protect it. Part of the whole thing is very interesting. It's inspiring people, inspiring the people that are already protecting their little neck of the woods to think that, to remember that they are part of a whole vast connected continent that needs them to hold fast throughout the years. And that there are resources out there. It might be somebody's phone number. It might be knowledge of this. It might be a scientific article. It might be a $1 million grant, but something is out there that might help you. And being connected to a network, to the network of people that are sharing this vision, suddenly becomes an asset to the partners. We can work more effectively. We recognize that the groups are more effective than individuals, and in the same sense, meta groups like a vast continental network can be more effective than smaller groups. Of course, it depends on scale. If you want to set up a fence, you don't need 600 people, right? But for certain processes, global processes, a vast network of groups concerned with conservation will be more effective.
So we have like 2 to 3 minutes left, and I guess I have two big questions. The first one is, so if there are people who are in the Western United States or Northern Mexico, or what can they, and then they care about this, what can they do to help either jaguars or this larger Western Wildway? And if somebody is not in the Western United States or Northern Mexico, but elsewhere in either the United States or elsewhere in the world, what can they do to help the jaguars and or the Western Wildway?
To people in Mexico, I would strongly encourage them to become members of Naturalia. Look for their website, naturalia.org.mx. And there are ways that you can become a member online. You can find their phone number there if you don't want to do the credit card transaction online or whatever. Membership is very important to groups in Mexico because it generates precisely the sort of revenue that the groups need to keep doing their work. Grants are few and far in between. So the constant trickle of people giving $5, $10, whatever each one individual can, actually becomes the strength of groups like Naturalia. If you're in the United States, if you want to do a tax deductible donation and you want to do it for the jaguars, look for Northern Jaguar Project online, just all together, .org. And the same is true here. You can do a donation. There are donations for equipment. Four-wheel drive vehicles are always needed. Tools, all kinds of things for keeping the reserve alive. The contact with ranchers and the outreach work with children and all other stakeholders going. And if your interest is in keeping the vision alive and helping us foster this understanding that landscapes should be connected at this scale, and you want to help Wildlands Network in keeping the groups connected and the people talking to each other, and also implementing very specific policy and place-based actions in critical junctures in time and place where we see that we are most needed, then do a donation to Wildlands Network, also wildlandsnetwork.org online. All these donations are tax deductible in the U.S. and, of course, in Mexico, Naturales donations are also deductible if you pay taxes in Mexico.
And then the last question is let's pretend that they suddenly you are made the king of all things jaguar. And And you're also, there's a fit of sanity, and the U.S. military, or the United States decides to spend money on protecting wildlife instead of blowing things up around the world. So you get a huge chunk of money from the military. So you've got a decent budget, and you can now design some policy. You can't, like, take down capitalism or stop agriculture. You can't do something that big. But within the current structure, what would you do to help jaguars if you could suddenly make a policy?
Jaguars specifically or all wildlife?
Well, we're running out of time, so do like two sentences for each.
Okay. They're probably very much the same. Identify the critical parts that they need protected and protect them, but seriously, seriously protect them from mining, from agriculture, from ranching, anything. Keep places wild like nature meant them to be. And then acknowledge that people need to do things, productive things, and accommodate those efforts elsewhere. Those that are not very harmful can be nearby these conservation cores. And then figure out how these cores need to stay connected so that animals can move about and adapt, for example, to climate change. And protect those corridors in some other way. Eliminate infrastructure that harms animals and sensitize people about the need to share the planet, share half of the planet at least, with the wild creatures.
Well, that's really great. Thank you so much for everything you've said. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Juan Carlos Bravo. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thank you, Derek, and thanks to all those listening.